Libyan media has trouble sorting fact from fiction. Eastern Libya has embraced the revolution with more fervor than the nation as a whole. The Catholic Church in Mexico moves to separate itself from the drug cartels, and U.S. drug companies face mounting losses as patents expire. I'm Jane Bornemeyer with a preview of the front page of Monday's New York Times. In our lead story, David Kirkpatrick writes that residents of Libya's capital city, Tripoli, were awakened before dawn on Sunday by the sound of artillery and gunfire in the streets. When they turned into state television broadcasts, they heard stunning news. The Libyan military had routed the rebels seeking to oust Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi. The gunfire, they were told, was in celebration. But Sunday was just another day spent through the looking glass of the oil-financed and omnipresent cult of personality that Colonel Gaddafi has spent 41 years building in Libya. Few of the claims by the Libyan state media lined up with the facts. There was no decisive victory by his forces, and the heavy firing in Tripoli on Sunday morning was never persuasively explained. Accuracy, consistency, and logic have never been the tenets of Colonel Gaddafi's governing philosophy, and their absence is especially conspicuous now as rebels pose the greatest challenge to his four decades of enigmatic rule. Not a day passes in Tripoli without some improbable claim by Colonel Gaddafi or the top officials around him. Yet the confusion and obfuscation appear to be part of Colonel Gaddafi's appeal to a segment of the Libyan population which admires his defiant promotion of his worldview. Anthony Shadid writes that the rebellion in Libya has proven far more violent, chaotic, and unpredictable than the uprisings in neighboring Egypt and Tunisia. Far from the front, in mood and reality, Beta, an eastern city that was one of the first to embrace the anti-Gaddafi revolution, has now also embraced the work of what might follow, building a state on a landscape riven by divisions of tribe, piety, and class, in a country whose leader spent four decades in power dismantling anything that might contest his rule. The new police chief has less than a third of his officers and worries that vigilantes might not surrender their weapons. He has no prison. Hundreds have volunteered for work, but on Sunday, many sat under a tent watching the news channel Al Jazeera. With revolutionary fervor and a resurgence of pride in running their own lives, residents have set up a slew of committees to impose order, distribute charity, and run schools. But even its own members admit they have more enthusiasm than experience. President Obama's deputy national security advisor visited a mosque in Sterling, Virginia on Sunday to reassure Muslims that the U.S. will not stigmatize or demonize entire communities because of the actions of a few. The White House billed the speech by the advisor Dennis McDonough as a chance for the administration to lay out its strategy for preventing violent extremism. But the timing was no accident. Mr. McDonough was in effect an emissary from the White House to preempt Representative Peter King of New York, the House Homeland Security Committee chairman, who has promised a series of hearings beginning Thursday on the radicalization of American Muslims. Mr. McDonough made no explicit mention of the hearings or of Mr. King, but his speech came on a day when the back and forth over Mr. King's plans echoed from the airwaves of Washington Sunday morning talk shows to the streets of Manhattan to the Northern Virginia suburb of Sterling. It's a region packed with Muslim professionals, many of whom are extremely wary of Mr. King and his plans. Also on the front, Duff Wilson writes that at the end of November, Pfizer stands to lose a $10 billion a year revenue stream when the patent on its blockbuster drug Lipitor expires and cheaper generics begin to cut into the company's huge sales. The loss poses a daunting challenge for Pfizer, one shared by nearly every major pharmaceutical company. This year alone, because of patent expirations, the drug industry will lose control over more than 10 mega medicines whose combined annual sales have neared $50 billion. It's a sobering reversal for an industry that just a few years ago was the world's most profitable business sector, and it casts a spotlight on the systemic problems drug companies now face, a drought of blockbuster drug breakthroughs and research discoveries, pressure from insurers and the government to hold down prices, regulatory vigilance, and government investigations, thousands of layoffs in research and development, and a new federal program to eventually allow generic variations of expensive biologic drugs. The investment house Morgan Stanley recently downgraded the entire group of multinational pharmaceutical companies based in Europe. The analysts wrote, "The operating environment for pharma is worsening rapidly." Damien Cave reports that the Roman Catholic Church in Mexico has been trying to confront its historic ties to drug traffickers. Long dependent on gifts, but often less than discriminating about where they come from, the church is grappling with its role and to find a new way forward as thousands die in turf wars between rich and sometimes generous criminals. The church has gone farther than before with public pledges to reject so-called narco alms and priests linked to traffickers. A handful of outspoken bishops have also recently stepped up their condemnation of both the cartels and the government's militaristic attempt to stop them. And finally, Sam Dillon writes that millions of public school students across the nation are seeing their class sizes swell because of budget cuts and teacher layoffs. The change is undermining a decades-long push by parents, administrators, and policymakers to shrink class sizes. Over the past 2 years, California, Georgia, Nevada, Ohio, Utah, and Wisconsin have loosened legal restrictions on class size, and Idaho and Texas are debating whether to fit more students in classrooms. Los Angeles has increased the average size of its ninth-grade English and math classes to 34 from 20. 11th and 12th grade classes in those two subjects have risen on average to 43 students. The increases are reversing a trend towards smaller classes that stretches back decades. Since the 1980s, teachers and many other educators have embraced research finding that smaller classes foster higher achievement. But budget cuts are forcing schools to raise class sizes, putting those who advocate shrinking them on the defensive. And that's a preview of the front page of Monday's New York Times. For more on these and other stories, pick up a copy of the paper or go to nytimes.com. For the New York Times Newsroom, I'm Jane Bornemeyer.